A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this prompt about customer service in Israel, and he's not wrong that the reputation is generally, shall we say, earned. He's been dealing with hardware stores during a move, placing orders, getting half his stuff missing, no apologies. And then when he calls, the rep sounds like they've just done a line and want him off the phone. The unmistakable feeling is that a 600 shekel order is small peanuts. Stop wasting my time. And his real question is, in a country of 10 million people where businesses prioritize the big ticket transactions to survive, is there actually a formula for good customer service? What are the unicorns doing that everyone else is missing? Are we doomed?
This is one of those topics where the surface complaint, customer service is bad, is actually masking a much more interesting structural question about how businesses scale in tiny markets. And I think the first thing to name is that what Anglo immigrants experience as bad customer service in Israel is often a collision of cultural expectations, not just negligence. There was a really good piece in the Times of Israel a while back that made this point directly. The Israeli concept of customer service doesn't always mean what Anglos think it means. In the EU or the UK, good service means deference, warmth. The customer is always right. In Israel, good service means the guy tells you honestly that the product you're about to buy is garbage and you should get the other one instead, even though he's losing the upsell.
The hardware store guy who says, don't buy that drill, it'll break in 6 months, buy this cheaper one. It's uglier, but it'll outlive you. That IS customer service here. It just doesn't come wrapped in a smile.
And that's the Dugri culture. Dugri is this Hebrew term for straight talk. No softening, no cushioning. It's a cultural value, not a failure of politeness. The problem is when Dugri slides into actual indifference. And I think what Daniel is describing is not the Dugri version of service, where someone is blunt but actually helping you. He's describing the version where the bluntness is a weapon to get you off the phone because your order genuinely doesn't matter to them.
The key distinction is whether the person on the other end is being honest in service of helping you, or being dismissive in service of getting rid of you. One is a cultural difference. The other is just bad business.
The question of why it's so prevalent gets into the economics. Israel has about 10 million people. For context, that's less than the population of Los Angeles County. You're trying to run a national retail operation for a market the size of one American county. The margins are brutal. So what happens is businesses naturally segment their customers and put their energy where the money is. The B2B client ordering 20,000 shekels of supplies every month gets a dedicated rep who answers on the first ring. The private consumer ordering 600 shekels once every 2 years gets the guy who's been told to keep call times under 90 seconds.
That's the rational part. I understand completely why it happens. But here's the thing that Daniel's prompt really gets at, and that I think is worth sitting with. He keeps a whitelist, a Rolodex of businesses that are the exceptions. They're big enough to be professional, wide inventory, quality product, and they take the time to guide you. These companies exist. They're operating in the same tiny market with the same margin pressures. So what are they doing differently?
Let's actually break that down, because I think there's a formula, and it's hiding in plain sight. The first thing the whitelist companies do is they've made a deliberate decision about who they're serving, and they don't try to be everything to everyone. In a market of 10 million, you cannot be the Walmart of Israel. You just can't. The companies that succeed at service quality have usually picked a lane. They're either B2C specialists who built their entire operation around the individual consumer experience, or they're hybrid operations that have separated their B2B and B2C channels so they don't compete for attention internally.
That internal competition is huge, by the way. If the same sales rep handles both the big contractor account and the random guy ordering shelf brackets, the random guy will always lose. The incentives are misaligned by design.
So separation of channels is step one. Step two is something I've noticed consistently with the whitelist companies. They invest in pre-sale guidance as a differentiator, not a cost center. The typical Israeli hardware store website is a catalog dump. Here's 1,000 SKUs. Good luck, figure out which bracket fits your shelf. The whitelist companies put real effort into guides, comparison tools, even WhatsApp consultation before you buy. And that pre-sale investment reduces the post-sale support burden dramatically.
Because the customer already knows what they're getting. Fewer returns, fewer angry calls, fewer missing items. Because the order was placed with actual human guidance on the front end.
And this is where the economics get counterintuitive. Most businesses in Israel treat customer service as a cost to be minimized. The whitelist companies treat it as a moat. In a word-of-mouth market, which Israel absolutely is, a good service reputation compounds. Daniel mentioned that he actively recommends his whitelist companies. That's free customer acquisition in a country where everyone knows everyone, or at least everyone knows someone who knows someone.
The Israeli social graph is absurdly dense. You're never more than 2 degrees from anyone, so a single good experience doesn't just retain one customer. It potentially acquires their entire social circle over time. And conversely, a single bad experience poisons an entire network.
There was a piece I came across in the Times of Israel that made this point in hard numbers. It cited research showing that better customer service directly correlates with more revenue and lower costs. The article argued that companies that invest in service quality actually save money on acquisition and retention, and they earn more through repeat business and referrals. In a small market, the math actually favors service investment more, not less, because word of mouth travels faster and hits harder.
Which flips the conventional wisdom on its head. The conventional wisdom is, we're a small market. We can't afford to invest in service because the margins are too thin. The actual math might be, we're a small market. We can't afford not to invest in service because reputation risk is concentrated and acquisition costs are otherwise punishing.
This is where I want to bring in something I've been watching in the Israeli tech ecosystem because it connects directly. Israel has a surprisingly robust customer service software sector. Companies like Zendesk have a big presence here, but there are also homegrown platforms. The innovation is happening. The tools exist. The question isn't whether the technology is available. It's whether the business culture is willing to adopt it in a way that centers the customer rather than just automating the dismissal.
The cocaine-fueled rep who wants you off the phone is not a technology problem. He's a culture and incentive problem. You could give him the most sophisticated CRM on the planet, and he'd still treat a 600 shekel order like an interruption.
Then the question becomes, what do the unicorns actually do structurally? I think there are about 4 or 5 patterns that show up consistently. Number one, they've killed the phone tree. You call, a human answers. In a country this small, you can actually do that. The volume is manageable if you've designed for it. Number two, they've embraced WhatsApp as a primary support channel, which is something very specific to the Israeli market. WhatsApp is basically the operating system of Israeli commerce. The smart companies meet customers where they already are.
WhatsApp changes the dynamic. A phone call is synchronous. High pressure, you're put on the spot. A WhatsApp message is asynchronous. The rep can handle multiple conversations. The customer can send photos of the problem. There's a written record. It de-escalates by its very nature.
Number three, and this is the one I think is most underappreciated, the whitelist companies have figured out that in a small market, your customer base is your R&D department. They treat complaints as free consulting. If 5 people in Jerusalem ask for a product variant you don't carry, that's not noise. That's a market signal you'd pay a research firm thousands of shekels to produce. In a market of 10 million, every data point is more valuable because the sample size is inherently limited.
That's a really sharp point. In a massive market, you can ignore individual signals because you got aggregate data that's statistically robust. In a small market, every signal is precious because you don't have enough data to be cavalier about it.
Number four, the whitelist companies have real inventory transparency. Daniel mentioned ordering items that turned out to be missing. That's the classic Israeli e-commerce experience. You order, you pay, and then you get an email 2 days later saying actually half of it wasn't in stock. The good companies have invested in real-time inventory systems. It's not glamorous, it's back-end plumbing. But it's the difference between trust and frustration.
Number 5, I'd add, is that the whitelist companies have somehow managed to hire people who don't sound like they hate their jobs, which in a customer service role in Israel, given the general public's own level of, let's call it, assertive communication, is hard. So they're either paying better, training better, or hiring for temperament in a way that most companies don't bother to do.
The hiring piece is huge. Customer service in Israel is often treated as an entry-level, minimum-wage, high-churn position. The whitelist companies treat it as a skilled role. They pay above market, they retain people, and those people develop actual product knowledge. When you call and the person actually knows what a platform truck is and can tell you which one fits your stairwell, that's not luck. That's retention and investment.
That brings us back to the economics. If you're paying above market for service staff in a low-margin business, you've got to make that money back somewhere. Where does it come from?
I think it comes from 3 places. First, lower acquisition costs through word of mouth, as we said. Second, lower return rates and fewer costly service escalations. Third, and this is the one that's harder to measure but I think is real, you can charge a slight premium. Not a massive one, but a few percent. The Israeli consumer will absolutely pay 5 or 10% more for a reliable experience because the baseline is so frustrating that reliability itself has monetary value.
The headache tax, essentially. People will pay to avoid the headache.
And we talked about this in a different context a while back. The idea that when prices flatten across a market, what decides where you shop isn't the price, it's the aggravation cost. In Israel, the aggravation cost of a bad experience is so high and so predictable that a company offering a reliably non-aggravating experience can actually command a premium.
Which is wild when you think about it. The market is so bad that being merely competent is a competitive advantage you can charge for.
That's also the opportunity, right? If you're an entrepreneur looking at the Israeli retail landscape, the bar is on the floor. You don't have to be exceptional by global standards. You just have to be not terrible by local standards, and you've got a business.
Okay, but let me push on something. Daniel's prompt asks whether we're doomed to always experience lousy customer service or if there's a pathway to success. We've identified the pathway, but I want to ask the doom question seriously. Is there something structurally about Israel that makes bad service sticky, that resists improvement even when the business case for improvement is clear?
I think there are 2 structural headwinds. The first is the one Daniel already named. The market is small, so B2B will always be the gravitational center for any business that can serve both segments. The temptation to neglect B2C in favor of the big accounts is not going away. The second is cultural in a way that's deeper than Dugri. There's an Israeli tendency toward what I'd call improvisational problem solving that works brilliantly in some domains and terribly in customer service.
Say more about that.
Israeli culture, and this is well documented, is extremely high on improvisation and extremely low on process adherence. It's why the startup scene is so good. You need to pivot fast, figure things out on the fly, ignore the manual. But customer service quality at scale is fundamentally about process. It's about predictable, repeatable systems. It's about doing the same thing well 10,000 times. That is not the Israeli cultural strength.
The national allergy to procedure.
It's a real thing, and you see it in everything from driving to queuing to contract enforcement. The Israeli approach is, rules are a starting point for negotiation, not a framework for consistency. That's a superpower in some contexts. In customer service, where the customer just wants their order to arrive complete and on time, it's a liability.
The whitelist companies are essentially fighting the cultural current. They're imposing process discipline in an environment that resists it.
That's why they're rare. It's harder to build that kind of company here than it is in, say, Germany or Japan, where process orientation is culturally embedded. The Israeli entrepreneur who builds a process-driven service company is swimming upstream.
That also means the ones who succeed have a moat that's cultural, not just operational. You can't easily copy what they do because it requires a level of organizational discipline that most Israeli businesses simply can't muster.
Which makes the whitelist more durable. It's not just that other companies haven't figured out the formula. It's that implementing the formula requires a kind of institutional personality that's scarce in this market.
Let me ask you about the U comparison that Daniel raised. He pointed out that in the U, the market is so vast that even an exclusively B2C business can afford quality support because the smaller pieces of the pie still add up. In Israel, you don't have that critical mass. Is that just a permanent disadvantage, or is there a way to compensate?
I think the U comparison is illuminating, but also a bit misleading. Yes, the U has scale that Israel can never match. But the U also has a customer service reputation that's wildly uneven. For every Zappos or Nordstrom, there's a Comcast or United Airlines. Scale doesn't guarantee quality. What scale does is create the possibility of specialization. You can build an entire business serving a niche that in Israel would be too small to sustain.
In the U, you can be the company that only sells left-handed gardening tools to people in the Pacific Northwest and still have a viable business. In Israel, your niche has to be broader, which means you're competing with generalists more often.
Here's the counterpoint. In Israel, because the market is small, the niche doesn't have to be product-based. It can be service quality-based. You can be the company that just does what the other companies do, but treats customers well, and that is your niche. In a large market, service quality is harder to use as a differentiator because there are usually multiple good options. In Israel, being the reliable option in a sea of unreliability is a genuine market position.
The niche of not being terrible.
It sounds like a joke, but it's not. In a market where the baseline expectation is frustration, competence is a brand.
Let's get concrete. If someone listening to this is running a mid-sized retail operation in Israel, maybe they're doing okay, but they're not on anyone's whitelist. What's the first thing they should change tomorrow morning?
I'm completely serious. If you do one thing, make WhatsApp a real support channel with a human being on the other end who has the authority to solve problems, not a bot, not an auto-reply saying your call is important to us, a person who can actually fix things. The infrastructure is already there. Every Israeli is already on WhatsApp. The cultural comfort is there. It's asynchronous, it's written, it creates accountability, and it's cheap relative to a call center.
It also generates a paper trail, which in a culture that's allergic to process is quietly revolutionary. You can't claim you never received the complaint when it's right there in the chat history.
The second thing I'd do is inventory transparency. If you don't have real-time stock data on your website, fix that before you spend a single shekel on marketing. The fastest way to burn trust is to sell something you don't have. And in Israel, this happens constantly. It's almost accepted as normal. But the whitelist companies don't do it.
The third thing, and this is harder, but I think it's the real unlock, is to change how you measure your service team. Most companies measure call time, tickets closed, throughput, which directly incentivizes the cocaine rep behavior. Get them off the phone fast. What if you measured resolution quality, follow-up survey scores, repeat purchase rate of customers who contacted support?
The metric drives the behavior. If you measure speed, you get rushed, dismissive service. If you measure resolution, you get actual problem solving. And in a word-of-mouth market, the resolution metric is the one that feeds your reputation.
The fourth thing, and this is the one that costs real money but I think pays back, is to stop treating customer service as a cost center and start treating it as a customer retention and acquisition engine. That means paying enough to retain people who actually know your products. The difference between a rep who's been there 6 weeks and one who's been there 3 years is the difference between, I'll check with my manager and I know exactly what you need. Let me walk you through it.
That's where the U comparison actually becomes instructive, not in the scale, but in the mindset. The best American customer service companies, the Zappos of the world, made a strategic bet that service is the product. The shoes are secondary. What you're buying is the confidence that if something goes wrong, a human being will fix it without making you feel like a burden. That bet pays off in any market size if you're willing to price accordingly.
Can an Israeli company actually charge accordingly? Is the market willing to pay the premium?
I think the evidence is yes, but with a ceiling. The Israeli consumer is price sensitive. Everyone compares prices. But they're also aggravation sensitive in a way that's almost unique because the baseline of aggravation is so high. I think you can charge maybe 5 to 15% more than the cheapest option if you're demonstrably reliable. Beyond that, you start losing to price competition. But 5 to 15% on a 600 shekel order is 30 to 90 shekels. That's real margin if you're doing volume.
That margin funds the better staff, the better systems, the inventory transparency. It's a flywheel if you commit to it.
The flywheel is exactly the right way to think about it. Good service leads to word of mouth, which lowers acquisition costs. Lower acquisition costs free up margin. Margin funds better service. Better service leads to more word of mouth.
The problem is, the first turn of the flywheel is the hardest. You have to invest before the reputation exists. And in a low-margin business, that takes either capital or conviction that most operators don't have.
Or it takes starting small and being patient. A lot of the whitelist companies didn't begin as the biggest player in their category. They started as a small operation that did one thing well, built a reputation, and expanded gradually. The reputation preceded the scale, not the other way around.
Which is actually a very Israeli story when you think about it. The startup that figures out one thing, proves it works, then scales. The difference is applying that mindset to something as unglamorous as hardware supplies instead of SaaS.
That's maybe the deepest point here. Israel has world-class entrepreneurial talent, but that talent overwhelmingly flows toward tech, toward export-oriented businesses, toward things that scale globally. The domestic retail sector doesn't attract the same caliber of business innovation. So you end up with a market where the smartest operators are building apps and the hardware store is run by someone who inherited it from their father and hasn't changed anything since 1995.
The brain drain into tech is real. The people who could revolutionize the customer experience at the local hardware chain are instead building the next Wix or Monday.com. Which is great for the economy, terrible for anyone trying to buy a platform truck without losing their mind.
I wonder if that's starting to shift. One of the things I've noticed, and this is more anecdotal than data-driven, is that the tech downturn of the last couple years has pushed some talent back toward domestic markets. People who would have been employee number 50 at a startup are now thinking, what if I just built a really good e-commerce operation for something boring? The boring businesses are suddenly interesting because the glamorous ones are harder to fund.
The unsexy opportunity. When tech is booming, nobody wants to sell shelving brackets. When tech tightens, shelving brackets start looking pretty good. They're recession resistant, everyone needs them, and the competition is largely incompetent.
That's the optimistic case for the pathway existing. The formula is known. The market is underserved. The tools are available. The cultural barriers are real but not insurmountable. What's been missing is the entrepreneurial energy directed at the problem. If that energy starts flowing, the whitelist could get a lot longer.
To answer the doom question directly, no, we're not doomed. The pathway exists. It's just narrow and uphill and requires a kind of discipline that doesn't come naturally to the local business culture. But the companies that walk it are proof that it can be walked.
I'd add one more thing. The consumer also has agency here. Daniel mentioned he keeps a whitelist and recommends companies. That's not just a coping mechanism. In a word-of-mouth market of 10 million people, consumer behavior actually shapes the market. Every time you choose the whitelist company over the cheaper but terrible alternative, you're casting a vote for service quality. In a small market, those votes add up faster than people realize.
The market is small enough that you can move it with your wallet. That's not true in the U, where your individual purchasing decisions are a rounding error. Here, a few thousand people consistently choosing quality over price would reshape an entire category.
That's the thing I'd want listeners to take away. If you're frustrated with customer service in Israel, you have two levers. One is the whitelist. Build it, share it, use it. The other is, if you're in a position to do so, build the business that makes the whitelist longer. The opportunity is sitting there.
The market is a mess. The mess is the opportunity. Same story, different sector.
Same story, different sector. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1783, during the Siege of Gibraltar, a French engineer named Jean-Claude de La Poipe designed a floating battery powered by a hand-crank generator that could send electrical shocks through the water to disable enemy divers attempting to sabotage ships. It was the first recorded attempt at an electroshock naval defense system. It did not work.
The first and, one assumes, last hand-cranked electroshock naval defense system.
I have so many questions about the testing process. So many questions. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a whitelist of your own, maybe share it with someone who's still suffering through the default experience.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.